All beneath the empty smile. Most cats in my area be loving a hysteria. Synthesized surface conceals the interior. America, land of opportunity, mirages and camouflages. More than usually, speaking loudly, saying nothing. You confusing me, you losing me. Your game is twisted, want me enlisted, and your usury. Foolishly, most men join the ranks cluelessly, but foolishly accept the deception, believe the perception. Reflection rarely seen across the surface of the looking glass. Walking the street, wondering who they be looking past, looking gas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andre Gillespie, who is a professor of political science at Emory University. Before joining the faculty at Emory, she worked as an analyst for Democratic pollster Mark Melman, and her current research focuses on the political leadership of the post-civil rights generation. She's the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America. She just was recently a Martin Luther King Visiting Scholar in the Political Science Department at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andre Gillespie.
Thank you very much. I should note that I'm back at Emory. I'm not at MIT anymore.
Oh, you aren't?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So the AP just did a poll on racial attitudes in the United States, and they found that they have not improved in the 4 years since the United States elected its first black president. In all, 51% of Americans now express explicit anti-black attitudes, compared with 48% in a similar 2008 survey. So how do you think this is going to impact the re-election of President Obama? Indeed, of course, that's assuming he does get re-elected.
Well, it will make it a little bit more difficult for President Obama to be elected. It won't make it impossible, but that means that there were some voters who may have been a little bit more inclined to support him who now have tapped into some conscious and subconscious racism, and that might actually prevent them from being able to cast a vote for President Obama.
Well, the assumption always is that in times of economic distress, people's darker side, if you will, come out, perhaps out of anxiety and confusion, and they're much more subject to demagoguery. When the president was elected, obviously President Bush had pretty much tanked, the economy had tanked, and the wars that he got us into were deeply unpopular. And then subsequent to the president's election, then the economy really tanked, and he's having a hard time pulling us out of it. So the conditions back then were much different today. I mean, there was, you know, I mean, arguably the president's election could be considered in some parts a repudiation of Bush rather than an embrace of Obama.
I think that that's somewhat accurate. In 2008, polling that was done that assessed during the Democratic primary which of the Democratic candidates was the better leader and which candidate was the better change agent, what we saw was that there was a difference between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Hillary Clinton was viewed as the stronger leader, but Barack Obama was viewed as the greater change agent. And when voters were asked what they were looking for in a candidate, they wanted change more than they wanted strong leadership. Historically, if we go back and we look at what people thought of Jesse Jackson when he ran for the Democratic nomination for president in 1988, for example, people rated him lower than his white counterparts on leadership. And so this seems to be an Achilles heel for African-American candidates. Obama overcame it because of the perfect storm of conditions in 2008, so not just the unpopular wars and the unpopular incumbent president from the opposite party, but then also the financial crisis and John McCain's somewhat bizarre response to the financial crisis. And so in the 4 years since, when people didn't see the dramatic, miraculous turnaround that they expected, people soured on Obama's leadership. And so some of those latent prejudices kind of came to the forefront. I think it's important to point out that with that survey, that they not only asked people explicit questions about their racial attitudes, but they also did subconscious tests. And so they found that implicit biases still do persist in American society and that those have an impact on how people perceive politics and on their vote choice.
So, Andre Gillespie, do these, you know, racist attitudes that people harbor that may be beneath the surface, does economic distress bring them out or does political demagoguery bring them out?
So political demagoguery, we know for sure, does. So and it's, we've known this for the last 20, 40 years. We can go back and observe this over history with the Southern Strategy, for instance, or even the types of visual images that have been used against candidates. particularly candidates of color when they run for office. Sometimes you don't have to say something that's explicitly racist because everybody knows that that's not acceptable anymore. All you have to do many times is show them a picture or invoke a code word in order to tap into that type of biased racial resentment against particular candidates of color. And so Black and Latino candidates in particular have to be very, very mindful, and their response has to be very explicit. And so people like Barack Obama don't like to talk about race because they want to appear to be inclusive, and they want to counter the stereotype that Black politicians only serve Black interests or Latino politicians only serve Latino interests. But when you are the victim of these subtle racial attacks, you or your surrogates need to be very explicit in pointing out that that's racist, because people know that they're not supposed to be racist anymore, and that can help neutralize some of that demagoguery.
Again, I'm speaking with Andre Gillespie, who's a professor of political science at Emory University and the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker Newark and Post-Racial America. So obviously then the dog whistle remarks by John Sununu, a campaign surrogate for Mitt Romney, in response to the news that Colin Powell had endorsed for a second time Barack Obama for president. He, of course, and we've been discussing this with Colonel Wilkerson, Colin Powell's former chief of staff, that he essentially gave, well, is this what happened? Did he give these Americans that hold these latent racist views, did he give them permission to feel that way by suggesting that the only reason that Colin Powell supports Obama is because they're both Black?
Yes, he did, but I should note that he wasn't the first. It wasn't the first time that he's done this, and it won't be the last in the next 9 days over the course of this particular cycle. So I actually probably would have preferred a much more stronger response on behalf of Obama and his surrogates to say that this was racist. I think a lot of people in the media kind of caught on to that. And what they're doing is they're tapping into a certain type of stereotype that, one, Blacks, because they're so uniformly Democratic in their voting behavior, are monolithic and they all think alike, and that people vote, or that African Americans in particular, vote for other Blacks because of race, as though other groups don't have an affinity towards people who have very similar backgrounds to them. And so, one, that needs to be pointed out. It probably needs to be pointed out a little more strongly than it has over the last couple of weeks. But given the fact that John Sununu has backed away from those comments and has now acknowledged that Colin Powell has substantive reasons to support President Obama and that race doesn't have to be the primary motivator for his decision to endorse him, I think is really, really important, and it speaks volumes. But I think most people have already made their decision about this race. And if people were hardwired to oppose President Obama on account of race, they were already comfortable doing that.
Well, but John Sununu's apology was less than sincere, shall we say, because he essentially changed the context for the remarks. He just made up a new context.
I mean, it's not my place to sit and judge a person's sincerity at all. It's just a question that I can say that it happened. It's a question that it looked racist and that it sounded racist, and the fact that he had to backtrack actually gives further credence to the fact that that was racially tinged and that there were racial overtones to it. That's significant enough. I mean, I can't be a person's priest or a shrink and get into people's heads. I can just go by what people have said. And so just sort of the train of events suggests that everybody acknowledges now that that was had racial overtones to it.
Right, but there's an expression, Andre Gillespie, that a lie goes around the world once before the truth has time to put its pants on.
I would agree. But given the fact that this race is very polarized and that there are very, very few undecided voters, that long-term impact of this over the course of the campaign is probably minimal. John Sununu had already made other comments that people thought were stereotypical, so it's not that people are discounting it. It's just that the people who are paying attention to those comments are the folks who've already made up their minds, not necessarily those who are undecided. Could it have an impact on undecided voters? Absolutely, but there are just so few of them at this point in the race that it would be really hard to tell what the long-term impact of it would be.
So I'm sure, Andre Gillespie, if the president is to lose this race, historians will point to the first debate and his lackluster performance there. And there's a certain mystery still surrounding what happened to the president. One of the interpretations that I'd heard is that he didn't take on Mitt Romney, who had appeared to have reversed himself almost entirely on all of the positions he'd taken over the last 2 years and suddenly was an overnight moderate. And the president did challenge him in a very polite way about this inconsistency. However, the theory that one hears is that the one thing that restrains the president from getting tough is the fear of appearing to be an angry black man. Is that something that you think is festering under the surface?
Oh, absolutely. And especially in the media coverage of the preparation for the first debate, the Romney campaign suggested that they wanted to try to get President Obama to kind of lose his temper a little bit and look aggressive. And so knowing that that was the strategy going into that debate, President Obama overcompensated and therefore underperformed in that first debate. And so he really does have to contend with stereotypes that black men deal with in the workplace, you know, in every sector of our economy. And so it's interesting to see that it doesn't matter how high one gets, still race is salient enough that even the president of the United States has to be careful about stereotypical images that relate to his race and his gender group.
And this Associated Press poll that just came out that indicates racial attitudes have not improved in the 4 years since the United States elected its first black president. Is there an overall sense of where America stands in terms of this historic change from the kind of atavistic Aussie and Harriet world that Ronald Reagan harkened back to when he was president, a world in which, going back to the American dream, the black and white version of it from Aussie and Harriet, where blacks and Hispanics were largely invisible. I spoke with Joan Walsh on Thursday. She's got a book about what's the matter with white men, or white people, I should say. And there is this question about holding on to a past that really never was as halcyon as people imagine it was, and this new emerging majority in the United States. How do you see that historic change? Because to my mind, if the president does win, it might well be that watershed where the minority majority become the majority.
Well, demographic changes suggest that, you know, in the next 30 to 40 years, the U.S. will not be majority white anymore. Whites will still be a plurality, but minorities collectively will make up more than 50% of the population. And so as a country, we're going to have to figure out what that looks like in terms of the distribution of power and economic resources and other types of things. I am very much influenced by my old teacher, Roger Smith, who co-wrote a book with Philip Klinkner called The Unsteady March. And one of the things that they really wanted to hone in on their examination of sort of civil rights history and politics in the United States is that we usually think about progress as being linear and always being progressive, but we always need to think about this being progressive and regressive. So you take a step forward, you take a step back, you take two steps forward, you take one step back. So we shouldn't have been surprised that there is the potential for a backlash to the Obama presidency. And so we've seen that with the rise of the Tea Party, and Tea Party sympathizers are disproportionately more racially resentful than people in the general population. Sort of the vehement sort of opposition to the president's agenda, even the narrowness of this particular election, suggests that President Obama may underperform relative to a white Democratic incumbent in previous years under the same types of conditions. These kinds of things suggest that race is still very salient and that we're all still trying to figure this out. And so while we're not at the 1960s, and so we're not going to go back to Aussie and Harriet, we're not going to go back to 1960 by any stretch of the imagination, we should have expected a kind of retrenchment from the euphoria of November 4th, 2008. And I think the thing that's probably been most interesting for this is that we haven't had many examples, you know, at high executive political positions in the United States. So we've had President Obama, and we've had a couple of black governors who have been elected since post-Reconstruction. So we usually look at black mayors. And so we knew in cities that when black mayors ran for re-election that they usually got a higher percentage of the white vote than they did when they first ran for election, and that whites who had served under African-American mayors or had lived under African-American mayors had different views about African-American leadership and competence in this particular area. Well, we don't see that happening at the national level, and part of that is that it's an apples-to-orange comparison. But there are other things now that I'm thinking about. So, for instance, you know, we usually think about in the 60s and 70s, and this is where the study that was done by Zoltan Heinol at the University of California at San Diego sort of plays out. You know, it doesn't, and you can't take into account the number of whites who leave cities when blacks become mayor, especially 30 and 40 years ago. This is not an option for most people to kind of expatriate themselves. So we have to kind of deal with the hand that we're dealt, and so people are uncomfortable with this. But this doesn't mean that 10 or 20 years from now that President Obama's legacy will be that it does actually push the needle forward. It's just going to be jagged progress as opposed to the nice, smooth, linear progress that I think in our own heads we kind of created this really rosy narrative that was really naive.
So you mentioned Andrew Gillespie, you mentioned the euphoria of 2008 when President Obama was elected, and I suppose to some extent it was a feel-good moment for a lot of people, particularly white folks who had never voted for a black president before. Has that dissipated? Do you think that was a one-time fluke?
Oh, clearly. Clearly, that level of euphoria was definitely one time. Could it happen again? No, I mean, people are usually beguiled by charismatic leadership, so I'm sure that there is somebody who is going to be able to engender that type of excitement at some point in the future. Hopefully, we learn to not place messianic expectations on our presidents anymore. They're humans, so they're fallible. Also, they're constrained in terms of the structure of the office. There are things presidents can't do, and our federal government with its system of checks and balances and a system of separation of powers is designed for slow incremental change. So you can't expect a president, or you can't expect Congress, or you can't expect the Supreme Court to be able to push widespread change. Do we have these moments where there are, you know, clear moments of clear direct change? Yeah, but overall, this process is going to be slow. It's going to be highly contested, and it's designed to be that way so that we don't have these radical shifts every few years, depending on who's in office or who isn't in office.
Well, just in closing, Andrew Gillespie, you're in Atlanta, Georgia, and, of course, the famous Southern Strategy under Richard Nixon was propelled by Lyndon Johnson signing the Civil Rights Act in 1965. Johnson remarked or lamented at the time that the Democrats would lose the South and lose the Dixiecrats. But in many ways, that could be argued as a healthy change. How would you assess the state of the Southern Strategy? And of course, it's worth noting that there was also a Northern Strategy, in a sense, of splitting the white working vote, eliciting the so-called Reagan Democrats or peeling them off. And of course, the anti-war protests in the Vietnam days, it did polarize that. And the blue-collar union folks, remember, they beat up the students, anti-war students. So, and Labor did not support McGovern, who just died recently. So I'm painting a broad historical brush here, but I'd like to get your final comment on it.
Well, I mean, there are parts of the Southern Strategy that are still in play today. So the Southern Strategy introduced the use of the code word to us. So earlier, segregationists in the South, and they were Democrats at the time, and many of them switched partisan allegiances later on, could openly talk about the biological inferiority of blacks, could support segregation, could use racial slurs, and it was considered perfectly acceptable. The Southern Strategy came about because it was no longer socially acceptable to be explicitly racist. So, you know, Nixon talks about law and order. He talks about freedom of choice in terms of school integration. And these kinds of things have taken on a life of their own today. So while the Republican Party has officially apologized for the use of the Southern Strategy, anytime you hear somebody like John Sununu say that President Obama was lazy in his first debate performance, people are going to read racial overtones and undertones into that, to point out where he may be priming racial resentment or priming a stereotype to get people to judge the president accordingly. When people talk about welfare, when Newt Gingrich invokes the food stamp presidency to talk about the Obama administration, knowing that most Americans overestimate the number of blacks who are on public assistance, and that we tie poverty and blackness to a larger degree, and to a growing degree of Latino-ness in the United States. Like, that's racial. When people show black criminals on television and invokes them in ads to talk about rapists, and, you know, it's not just Willie Horton. This was used against Deval Patrick when he ran for governor of Massachusetts in 2006. Like, these kinds of things are the legacy of the Southern strategy. So in many ways, the Southern strategy never went away. It's just that certain people who perpetrated it originally or who are standing in for them have now apologized for them. But that doesn't stop people from, you know, subtly invoking race to be able to make a point and to tap into subconscious racism. So I think the Southern strategy is very much still a part of this larger discussion that we've been having.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Andra Gillespie.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Andra Gillespie, who's Professor of Political Science at Emory University. Before joining the faculty at Emory, she worked as an analyst for Democratic pollster Mark Melman, and her current research focuses on the political leadership of the post-civil rights generation, and she's the author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America. She just was recently a Martin Luther King visiting scholar in the political science department at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how come the Chinese Premier Wen Jiabai's family have accrued wealth worth $2.7 billion.